Well, today we'll begin a sermon series, and usually when I do a sermon series, I'll say this is going to last 3 weeks or 5 weeks, and often it ends up lasting 10 weeks or 12 weeks. So I'll prepare you ahead of time that who knows where this will end. But the basic idea of this sermon series is, and I think the hint of it is in the title of the sermon, round pegs and square holes, not whether they fit or not, because I think that's a problem to even ask that question, whether they fit or not. Because the question that I want to address is that, does Unitarian Universalism, or can Unitarian Universalism, with the seven principles we think about and talk about at least once a week, can they be and exist in a culture, the culture that we live in? Can the value system of the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion, social justice, the democratic process, exist within the context of an economic system that's profit-driven? Or do round pegs simply need to find other round pegs and move up in the hills and leave the squares alone? Well, then the question becomes, would the squares leave the round pegs alone?
No.
That's the question. We just got a notice of tax increase. $250? $250 for something that we'll go to the meeting and certainly bark about. I don't know if we have any teeth in our bark, but we're going to find out. But that's the point, isn't it? That if we have to pay more money to exist, what do I cut? Can I not be just left alone? Am I not doing enough? Or do I have to take who and what I am, round peg, and try to fit in a place that I cannot fit? I think in our reading today, we get a hint of that also. In the sentence that we have religion when we hold some hope beyond the present, some self-respect beyond our failures. And I'm suggesting today that if we have no sense of self-respect or no sense of self-affirmation beyond our failures, we're going to try to fit where we don't fit. If our sense of failure or our sense of inadequacy or our sense of non-being or our sense of negativity comes upon our own self, and that is where we end in our thought processes, we will try to fit where we do not fit. We will look for self-affirmation, and we will look for love, and we will look for care where it does not exist. We have to move beyond our failures, beyond what we might interpret as shortcomings, which might not be shortcomings at all. It might just be that I'm a round peg. But how in the world could I come to the conclusion that what I am, fully what I am, is inadequate, is lacking? How can that possibly be? For I just am who I am. How could I get to a place where I would interpret that who and what I am is not good enough? These will drive me nuts. And I'm suggesting today that how I can, and I think I need to ask that question, there are times that I might even settle and actually stop asking questions about my negative self-interpretation, I guess we could sum that up and say, and just begin to live as if that's normal. And begin to manipulate the world around me, trying to seek some affirmation and acceptance and some pleasure, but not having any come from within me, out of me. That is a danger we live in this culture. because we are taught in this culture we lack as individual human beings because we have to acquire not to lack, but then when we acquire not to lack, we are taught we're still lacking. Today, I'm going to have to also integrate the 4th of July, the celebration of this nation, and I would say great nation, because I'm a citizen of this nation, but how many of us struggle when we call this nation great nation? We could certainly say we hear greatest nation on the earth, but some of us think that we're the nation leading the destruction of the earth. How can the greatest nation lead us? But some of us think, wait a minute, we still have a voice. We can still protest. We're caught in a dilemma. And I'm going to suggest today, the keener our awareness of our history personally and our history about our country, the keener we are aware of that history, the more we can move beyond any sense of failures or any sense of lack and have some self-respect in which we can stand up and speak clearly from, and we can begin to carve out a place in our culture where we can actualize the values of Unitarian Universalism. And to begin that journey of gaining some keen sense of our own history, I've got some questions, and naturally, as a counselor, I start with the inward journey, because that's where we start every morning when we get up. We start with our own self, our own inward journey. I'm getting old because my back hurts when I get up. However that inner journey may begin itself, it may begin itself there. And the questions I have to start there is this. Am I aware of how I affect others? Are you aware of how you affect others? Or is that even a concern? Or is that so much a concern that I will adjust my true self to affect others in a particular way, thinking I'm going to get the needs I need to have met, to get my needs met? Or do I adjust myself so that I don't have to deal with myself, my own history? Have I organized my life so that I don't have to deal with who I really am or with things that have happened to me in my past? How do I believe, how do I affect others? Do I even ask that question? Do I even coordinate with how I affect others with what I want to get out of my life? Or am I somehow in a system where I affect others and I actually am part of the process that sets up the situation where I don't get my needs met? Do I self-sabotage my own needs? How many of you have a sense of what that is, or have you ever struggled with that? That somehow you're in a relational process with self and others, and you ultimately don't get what you want out of life, when life does have to offer you what you want and what you need. I can remember sitting in a group meeting in my training, and my supervisor said to me, "How do you think others perceive you?" My mind was nowhere near, nowhere on that question. I had no idea what he was even talking about. It was not even a thought. I was just bumbling through this world thinking everybody, of course, would have my same values and of course would like me and of course this and of course that. But at midterm, we had an event, and I don't know if he set this up, but he was the kind of person that would set something like this up. He said, "Well, we're going to have an evaluation and the students are going to evaluate the supervisors." And when the students were evaluating me, supervisor in training, I got a gift of a Smurf with the rope, you know, the little Smurf statues? And the words were, this guy's going to round you up whether you wanted to be rounded up or not. Another student gave me a needle and said, you need to anesthetize yourself before you go into supervision with this guy. So the supervisor says, Gregory, do you have any understanding of what effect you have on other people? And I had not a clue that I might think about how I affect others, how I might break through my own infantile or my own, not in a negative way, infantile, but my own immature narcissism, not being aware of others, because that's what that is. I'm not saying that in a harmful or belittling way, but not to be concerned with others and how I affect others, not in the manipulative, codependent kind of way to get my needs met, but in a very real, genuine kind of way. If I'm not concerned with how I affect others and I'm just not even a thought, that is an immature narcissism. I mean, it just is. And I needed to grow up. And he liked me and he was willing to help me grow up by allowing and setting up the stage for the students to give me some direct feedback. And they did give me some direct feedback. And that's the question that's crucial to our spirituality, and it's crucial to the Unitarian Universalist principles. Because if we're not asking that question, we can't get to the question, how is my own personal history and how is national history affecting me as a person and affecting our culture? If I can't get to that individually with my own inner world, I can't step out and genuinely get to that in a larger way. So I brought an example of that in integrating July 4th. And this is why I think we do have a great nation, because I can do this. Okay. We got this newspaper, and it says the American Revolution, how the 13 colonies united and won their independence, and a flintlock musket, and they got some heroes down here, and the means of war, and fought side by side, and the hour of discontent. And the war is expensive. Well, we know that. Do you know how much money they're going to spend on this war this year? When they added it all up, because now they're running money through the State Department, doesn't show up in budget. $1 trillion. I'm not making that up. War is expensive. So when we think about our nation, we also have to think this. But there's something missing. There's something missing on this page. You also notice our flag looks like the flag from the John Company. East Indian Company. That was a international corporation back then. It's curious that. But anyway, there's something missing from that page. Now, there's a theologian, H. Richard Niebuhr, and he talks about Revelation. And he says, Revelation is the moment in time when you realize something and you look back at your history and you say, oh, now I understand. That's the moment of Revelation. I don't know how many of you ever had that moment of revelation where you begin to realize something and you think, oh, that's what that's about. Or when you might have somebody suggest to you that you are indirect with your anger. And that indirectness of anger, and you might even decide and figure out where that has come from, because people bigger than you are angry, and if you expressed your anger, you got their anger, so you learned to be indirect with your anger, something like that. But then you look back through your history and you see the cost of being indirect with your anger in relationships. And you think, oh, that's what that was about. That's revelation. That's the moment of revelation. And so then you know your history more, and then you know you need to work to be direct with your anger. Because if you can't be direct with your anger, intimacy and personal relationships is more difficult. So being direct with your anger is good. But I wouldn't have known that unless I had a keener awareness of my history. So here's what's missing from that page, and it does affect our spirit, what's missing from that page, and it's hard to get a hold of how that affects our spirit unless we know what's missing from that page. And this is a to the tradesman mechanic of the province of Pennsylvania. And I'm going to guess the year is 1810. But I forgot to get to here, but it's early. Maybe it's earlier than that. And this is talking about the East Indian Company. And what the East Indian Company was, a company that was chartered by England to control basically all the trade east of England, all the way to India. So, yeah, that's a funny thing too, that a country can say to a company, you can have half the world, and anything that gets in your way, you do what you want with it. Okay. So that's in the world of our revolution. The East Indian Company, if once they get a footing in this once happy country, our country, they will leave no stone unturned to become your masters. They are an opulent body, and money or credit is not wanting amongst them. They have a designing, depraved, and despotic ministry to assist and support them, which was England. They themselves are well-versed in tyranny, plunder, oppression, and bloodshed, whole provinces laboring under the distress and oppression, slavery, famine, and the sword are familiar to them. Thus they have enriched themselves, and they have become the most powerful trading company in the universe. Here's where it comes to our spirit. Typical of the sort of invading was an attempt in 1801 by several of New York's wealthy merchants. What happened during the American Revolution, the revolution wasn't a revolution against England. It was a revolution against England's relationship with the East Indian Company, who was oppressing the colonies. And we have to have that triangle to understand our country, that our country was a revolution against two entities, not one entity. And if you leave out one of the entities in trying to understand our country, you can't understand our country, especially if the entity that's absent is the one diminishing our spirit. Then our spirit is being diminished, and we have no place to figure it out. We have no way to understand it. If I continue to stay indirect with my anger, and I continue to suffer in relationships, intimacy-wise and closeness-wise, and I have a low-grade depression because of it, but I never look at my history, I can never figure out what that's about because I don't know it. But the same thing goes on for nations. This person says, there were people after we set boundaries against the corporations, people try to come back with it. Typical of the sort of invading was an attempt in 1801 by several New York's wealthy merchants, including a brother-in-law of Alexander Hamilton named John Church, to get a charter that would allow them the exclusive right to provide bread to the city, hiring previously independent bakers to perform the work. When they caught wind of this bald attempt to drive them out of business, the bakers employed the full force of the Jeffersonian rhetoric. The Jeffersonian rhetoric was eliminate corporations completely, arguing that if the legislature granted such a charter, the independent spirit so distinguished at the present in our mechanics and so useful in republics would be entirely annihilated. What they were saying, that the beginning of our nation, what invigorated us, what Channing talked about that invigorated us, was that people had a way in our country to better themselves. If you knew a trade, even if you didn't have any money, you could set up a trade to better yourself. There was a dream and there was a vision in our country that no matter what station, what class we were born in, if we got an education or we learned a trade, we could live better. We could do more. We wouldn't be indentured servants. We wouldn't be slaves. We could do better. We could do more. It even got to the point prior to the revolution, well, this is one reason for the revolution, that there was a law that enforced the natural resources from the colonies to be shipped to England to be made into goods, pots, pans, and then shipped back to the colonies. And it was against the law to do it differently. That's what they were rebelling against. What this paper leaves out is an effort by others to accumulate wealth to end that independent spirit that we could better ourselves, live a better life. And the people who were writing against that and challenging that said, if you do that, the spirit of who we are as a nation will become depressed, annihilated. How do I get from there to our principles today? When I think of, we were talking in the group earlier, before the service, about the incident where a woman was in a hospital waiting to be treated, and she bled to death in the hospital. And I'm wrestling with the principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Can that principle be actualized in our country? But to the best of my knowledge, the policy that created that situation hasn't been changed. And when we have, I'm going to say, a needless death, and by the way, there's 18,000 needless deaths a year because we don't have national health insurance. When we have premature deaths, and there's no protest and there's no outrage, I'm thinking our spirit's diminished. There's something going on that we're depressed. There's something going on that we continue to go by that hospital. There's something going on when we know that there are systems in our nation that ignore people and consider them, as harsh as this may sound, we live in a system that consider them, that consider us, that consider me of no account. There's a depression in our nation. And I think the people that were back during the time of the Revolutionary War knew what they were talking about when they said, when you had accumulated money that hired tradespeople as workers and eliminated the spirit that we had some sense of freedom about ourselves, that spirit of independence, not of rugged individualism, that spirit of independence that we need in life would be annihilated and diminished. That person was indirectly saying, you can't live out those seven principles if we allow this company to control the money system in the early part of our nation. You can't allow that. He's saying that our seven principles can't exist in that context. It just can't work. And so we wrestle with our own inner world. How is it that I assent to, that I agree to a value system, and yet every day I participate in a system in which that value system can't live? The person that was sharing that story about the woman in the hospital said, that hurt. I thought this was a country that. We got to thinking about that a bit more, and what occurred to me, we have some basic assumptions about this great nation on this soon to be July 4th. And those basic assumptions are that people in leadership follow a certain ethical process. And because they follow that certain ethical process, I can have faith that this country is going to move and behave in a particular way. And I assume that's true. In the American Association of Pastoral Counselors, in which is the organization in which I am certified, I have to say I'm going to follow a guideline, a certain ethical process, in order to be a member of that group. And I'm accountable to that group. And that group has a method a method in which they can look at me and hold me accountable. And I like it. And it's good. Anybody that wants to talk to me and goes and visits the website and looks at the ethical process has some assumption that I'm functioning in that context, that ethical context. And under that assumption, and with that assumption, there's some sense of trust and safety in which we can accomplish the task of whatever pastoral counseling might be. And it's an assumption. When the medical community and doctors take an oath about how they're going to care, income is not in that oath. We have a basic assumption that when we go see somebody who's taken an oath that we will care for you and we will do no harm, that that's the truth of the matter. And that assumption from the American Association of Pastoral Counselors to the Medical Association, to medical care, to, I'm going to guess, massage care, whatever it may be, whatever association you're with, is what structures our society. The mechanics and the tradesmen in the early Revolutionary War said, if you legislate laws allowing these people to control all of the bakeries in New York City, and we can only work for this company in New York City, you're breaking down the assumptions that make us a free people, is what that guy, what that group of people were saying. We have a case today where an accountability office, the General Accounting Office, said that they wanted information from somebody in the executive branch, or maybe he's not in the executive branch, maybe he's in the legislative branch. We don't know. Of course, when they voted to defund, that part of the executive branch was not in the executive branch. Some things changed. But anyway. The person that they were going to hold accountable to give them information threatened to defund the General Accounting Office. Think of that triangle as far as our social assumptions and social contracts go. The vice president said, if you pursue this inquiry, we will just withdraw the funds from the General Accounting Office and you'll no longer exist. The accounting process is under the controls of those who need to be held accountable. That would be like me controlling the ethical board, the American Association of Pastoral Counselors, and somebody sending a complaint about me and saying, if you entertain that complaint, I'll withdraw whatever power you have. Social contracts and assumptions of our structure of society are extremely important, and they are extremely valuable, and when they begin to break down, our spirits become depressed. Because they're there to structure a democracy and a representational democracy so that it works. That's what they're there for. And any of you that have ever taken an oath or any of you that ever looked at ethical standards, you said, yes, I'll agree to these ethical standards. Yes, I will take this oath in this role that I'm going to play in this society. That structures our society. And the rest of us have a belief that you will do that. So when we receive your services or engage you in that role, we have a trust. We have a faith that you will uphold those ethics, those ethical standards, and we can feel safe in that process. And we have really worked on trying to understand emotional safety within this congregation. We also need that sense of safety. So when I think about our seven principles and I read our seven principles, not in isolation. When I read those seven principles in terms of taxes, because taxes are really symbolic of who we are, how our taxes are spent, are symbolic of who we are as people. Our taxes represent us, or don't they? Or don't they? And if they don't, where is my voice of protest? Do I join the tradespersons and the mechanics in 1803 that said to the New York legislature, do not pass that legislation? Because if you pass that legislation, the spirit of freedom and the spirit of being able to be a person who's not going to be impinged upon, who's not going to be used, who's not going to be manipulated by others to become who they want me to be to serve them, that I'm going to be free of that, that I can walk and design my own life and make meaning for my own life, that will be taken away from me. Don't do that. When we see that being done today, are we in the spirit of those tradespersons that say, don't do that? Or are we already in a position where our spirit is depressed and annihilated, that which they warned us would happen? They warned us that would happen. And I'm going to say, if that is so, then somehow we need to put some action to our depression. And when we do that, we will leave our depression. And there is only one action to take if this is the depression. And that is the action of protest. That is the action of putting a voice to my inner workings. When I say what's going on is wrong inside myself, I need to have a community that welcomes the voice that's wrong. And we need to do something about it more than just in these walls. We need to do something about it more than in these walls. On this July 4th, we Unitarian Universalists confront the truth that in this governmental and economic system, the way it stands today, this minute, our values are not having their way. They're just not. And if it continues in the direction it's been going in for 30 years, our values will be completely disconnected from the land in which we live. Today, that is not so. Our values do have some hold today. And there are voices out there that are actualizing our values, not just Unitarian Universalists, but many people that are actualizing those values that we can join with and be with. But we need to get in touch with that spirit that was born back at the Revolutionary War that says, do not legislate power to these people that will annihilate our personal freedom. We need to get in touch with that spirit. And we need to claim our heritage and who we are as citizens and say, yes, we stand with those people. And we stand with those people by voicing our protest today. Then we will create a community and where those seven principles can be actualized, where we can enjoy ourselves and we can feel the care and the love of a community, and we can let that depression go out the door and bring in excitement about life and not be victims, but be those who stand in protest. For that is who we are as Unitarian Universalists. So be